different, something that we've done over the years now. Rabbi Glenn and Alexandra, Martha and I are going to discuss a chapter of Proverbs. Proverbs, in my opinion, is a much underutilized book in the Bible. It is very valuable. It is one of the wisdom books. God designed it to give us wisdom, and wisdom is such a valuable thing. And it is great for couples to sit down together, read the Bible, specifically Proverbs, and talk about it and discuss it and try to figure out ways to implement these various Proverbs. So that's why we have these two couples. Martha and I will often read Proverbs together and discuss them, and probably Rabbi Glenn and Alexandra. In fact, Rabbi Glenn is now having a weekly discussion on Proverbs Wednesday mornings at 6:30 a.m. Wednesday Wisdom. So encourage you to join Rabbi Glenn for that. Let's turn to Proverbs chapter 21. Our goal this morning is to go through the first half of it, the first 15 verses, and then next week, Lord willing, the last half of Proverbs. Proverbs is designed to be short, pithy sayings, teachings that can be applied to various aspects of life. Verse 1, the king's heart is like a stream of water directed by the Lord. He guides it, he guides the king's heart wherever he pleases. Martha, let's start with you. Any thoughts?
It's very human to look at the circumstances in front of us and think that that's the full story. And when we look at the king, we see the seat of power. But this is telling us that the seat of power resides with the Lord. And even the king serves him. And I feel like the overturning of Roe v. Wade is a good example of this, where it looked like it was just impossible to have this change. And even the president is against this, and yet God is the seat of power, and he moved it where he wanted it.
Alexandra.
I like what Martha said. In the final analysis, every
knee... Can you speak closer to the mic so we can...
Every knee will bow to Jesus. Every king, prime minister, dictator, and president. And yet in the meantime, I wonder, was King Solomon, if he's the one that wrote this proverb, was he talking about wicked kings? Like when you think about the North Korean prime minister, president, whoever, whatever that title is, and how long he's getting away with such wickedness. Like, is God still directing that? He's obviously not directing that, but like you said, Martha, ultimately his will prevails.
Rabbi Glenn.
Well, the thing about water is it's powerful stuff. You will never win in a battle against water. It always finds its way down. But as Martha said, Adonai is all powerful. Even the kings of the earth will eventually bend to his will or be broken. So there's hope for us.
Streams of water, rivers can be redirected. There's like engineering corps that redirect in the United States, the Army Engineering Corps, it redirects, rivers to make the rivers go where the Army Corps of Engineering wants the rivers to go. And just like they can do that, the Lord directs the minds, the hearts of the most powerful rulers, the most powerful people to accomplish his plans, his purposes. They are not in charge. They might think that they're in charge. They might think they're in control. Behind them is the all-seeing, all-powerful God who is directing them to accomplish his goals and his purposes. And even with that wicked dictator of North Korea, you know, God is behind him, and he is allowing him to do what he does for now. But, you know, that is part of what God's plan is. And so that should be comforting. You see a wicked ruler or a bad, you know, ruler, powerful people, think to yourself, they are ultimately fulfilling God's plans and God's purposes. Verse 2, people may be right in their own eyes, but the Lord examines the heart. Rabbi Glenn.
People may be right in their own eyes? May? We're always right in our own eyes. I give you Facebook. All right. But the fact is, and I think of Jeremiah 17, mankind is spiritually broken. And one of the symptoms of our brokenness, our sinfulness, is that we are prone to self-deception. We're sure that we're right. And we are prone to give ourselves more moral credit than we deserve. But the Lord is omniscient. He's altogether righteous and just. And he is going to render a true and right verdict about us on that fast approaching day.
And he's the only one that has the right to, because he is the one who sees what's in our hearts. We can't even see what's in our own heart without the help of the Holy Spirit, because the heart is deceitful and wicked above all things. It's our brokenness, but God sees what we can't see.
Alexandra, any thoughts?
Continuing that thought with Jerry's favorite Bible verse, Rabbi Jerry's favorite Hebrews 4:12, where we have the help of the scripture that will help us to see dividing between the soul and the spirit and will save us some embarrassment on that day of judgment where every careless word is revealed.
I will add this, that human beings have this amazing ability to self-justify, to excuse their actions, to think they're always doing right. Magnify the faults of others, have a log in their eye while they're picking out, you know, the splinter in another person's eye. We cut ourselves breaks every time we do something wrong. We don't allow, you know, give others that same break. So this is the way it is. People are right in their own eyes, but the Lord really knows what's going on. Verse 3, the Lord is more pleased when we do what is right and just than when we offer him sacrifices. Alexandra, let's start with you.
Doing what is right is sometimes private, and offering a sacrifice seems more of a public thing. So one thing I've been trying to do lately is to commit each thing that I do to the Lord and try to do it with all my heart. And sometimes they're just little things, you know, like working at the cafe and trying to clean up the espresso machine, or the things that come up in my life has been very busy lately. And it feels like I go from one task to another unrelated task to another unrelated task. So it's been a challenge, and I haven't always succeeded, but I think that that I'm hoping that's pleasing to God, that we can just kind of walk through each task and commit it to him.
And I think this is making the point that if we do not have a righteous desire to live righteously and a righteous life backing up the sacrifices, God's not interested in those sacrifices.
Rabbi Glenn.
Well, think about the ancient world when the temple existed and the bringing of animal sacrifices. Those animals cost money. It was expensive. It costs money to offer those things, but God isn't impressed by how religious we are. Not at all. Religion is no substitute for a life of honesty and integrity and kindness. And putting money in a plate does not offset dishonesty or cruelty. And put all the money in the world in a plate will not offset that. God is more concerned with the way we conduct ourselves towards one another in this world than all the religious activity we could muster.
Exactly. A lot of people, religious people, focus on the external aspects of religion, what it looks like, got to do this, got to do that, got to do this. God is much more concerned with the internal aspects of religion, what's in our hearts, if we're doing, you know, committed to do what is right in our heart towards other people, and what is right toward God, be in a right relationship with God. So that is much more important than any of the external aspects of religion. Verse 4, haughty eyes. Haughty means like high. High eyes, haughty eyes. A proud heart and evil actions are all sin. Rabbi Glenn.
Well, haughty eyes is sort of like that when a person looks down their nose, right? That body, you can see by the body language, an imperious kind of attitude. But a proud heart, not all sin is outwardly obvious. But what is in our hearts is on open display to him. So, and he detests arrogance. And the thing is, evil actions flow from an evil heart. So eventually, you'll know what kind of person you're dealing with based on their actions. You will know them by their fruits.
And I think it's also making the point that not just actions are sin. Haughty eyes, a proud heart, are attitude. And oftentimes, the attitude doesn't show on the outside, but God sees it, and it's sin to him. And also, haughty eyes, body language, does matter. So we better be careful how we conduct our body language to other people.
Alexandra.
It struck me that when Jesus was preaching his Sermon on the Mount, it wasn't anything new. I mean, this is the Old Testament, and the evil actions are obvious, lying and theft and murder, but haughty eyes, disdainfully looking down on others, having a very high opinion of oneself. Like you said, Martha, that's always been sin. It's not like Jesus didn't reveal some new thing when he was preaching what is in your heart counts as sin.
Verse 5, good planning and hard work lead to prosperity, but hasty shortcuts lead to poverty. Martha, let's start with you.
There's a real contrast here. Good planning and hard work seem to be a key in leading to prosperity. And the pattern with good planning is that it takes time, patience, forward thinking, considering your options, weighing strengths and weaknesses of the different options. These things take time and patience. And the contrast is hasty, impulsive, impetuous shortcuts that have consequences, because it says it leads to poverty when you handle things that way.
Rabbi Glenn.
Well, this is one of those verses in Proverbs where it's a good idea to remind ourselves that the Proverbs are not ironclad guarantees that if you do this, this will happen. Some things that people take as promises from God are not promises. In this case, it's a general truth. Generally speaking, diligence, consistency leads to prosperity, but not always. Some people plan well. Some people work hard. They don't get the breaks. They don't necessarily become wealthy. Shortcuts don't always lead to poverty, but they seldom lead to anything good. And this is something important. Shortcuts can even be deadly. Now think about people taking shortcuts in constructing things, bridges, buildings, aircraft. It can be deadly. So beyond the issue of prosperity or poverty, it is so important that we do what we do conscientiously.
Well said. Alexandra.
Mine was a bit of a tangent because I was focusing on the hastiness and I was thinking about shortcuts. Why are they? They're not always bad. Like if you find a shortcut in traffic, you just get there faster. But usually trying to get to prosperity faster is a mistake. And then I was thinking about the hastiness, you know, in my new job, when we get busy, there's one girl where she just gets flustered. And every time we get busy, she breaks something and it takes longer to clean up all the glass shards and everything. So I was talking to Levi about it and he quoted a line from a TV show. He said, slow is smooth and smooth is fast. And so I'm trying to keep that in mind. You just like work efficiently, work slowly, don't be hasty, don't break the glasses.
If you have come to Shema for any amount of time, you'll hear me go off on a rant on the wicked prosperity teachers, right? Well, this is the true prosperity teaching. Good planning and hard work lead to prosperity. That's pretty much it. Hasty shortcuts lead to poverty. You know what a hasty shortcut that leads to poverty is? Listening to the prosperity teachers. Yeah, it's a hasty shortcut. It's a lie. People think they're going to get rich quick by using their faith. It's a hasty shortcut. It's a lie. There's no substitute for good planning and hard work. That is what generally leads to prosperity, but like Rabbi Glenn said, not always. Another proverb about accumulating wealth, verse 6. Wealth created by a lying tongue is a vanishing mist and a deadly trap. So think about someone who's a con artist, someone who lies, fraud, to accumulate wealth. Rabbi Glenn, any thoughts?
Well, lying to get rich is the definition of fraud. But there's underlying that the whole idea of pursuing wealth as your goal in life is really short-sighted. It's really inadvisable. Pursuing wealth as your goal, it will inevitably cause you to compromise your principles. It will frequently lead to moral failure, such as fraud, lying in business. And God loves us too much to allow that to succeed. He will reveal it. He will allow us to hit that wall if we resort to dishonesty.
Alexandra.
Also, wealth created by following the devil unintentionally or intentionally. I listened to Doreen Virtue. She was one of the top New Age sellers of books and cards and things. And the people on her channel who were formerly in New Age, they had gotten so wealthy. And yet all of them said, it's like I was making all this money and I never had money. I came out of this, I was in debt. It's almost like a mirage, a vanishing mist that the God of this world can provide in this weird way.
And not only is wealth gotten this way, very likely to disappear. But it's also a deadly trap. That's really strong language. When people are caught in fraud, they don't just lose their wealth. They can lose their whole life. They can end up in jail, lose their reputation, ruin their family's happiness. There's a lot of deadly consequences.
Well, that's exactly what happened to Bernie Madoff, who did this Ponzi scheme and made off with a lot of people's money and wound up in jail, and his son committed suicide. So how you get your money is very important. Not just getting money, but how you get it. Hard work, good planning, yes, lying, fraud, cheating, deceiving, conning people, taking shortcuts, absolutely not. This past week or so, there was this company, this cryptocurrency company. It was promising investors a return of like, if you would give this company your cryptocurrency, they would give you like 17% interest, which is very high. And it's like a lie. It's like impossible to give, you know, someone 17% interest on a cryptocurrency unless you're doing something crazy, loaning that money out, leveraging it up. And of course, like the whole thing imploded. Billions and billions of dollars vaporized. And, you know, people invested like their entire life savings into this thing. So wealth created by a lying tongue is like a vanishing mist. It's like a fog. The sun comes up and it just disappears, that mist, a deadly trap. Verse 7, the violence of the wicked sweeps them away because they refuse to do what is right, what is just. Rabbi Glenn.
The word refuse is the key here. There's a choice being made for someone where they're disregarding what they know to be true and the right thing. So this isn't ignorance at work. This is rebellion.
Alexandra.
Continuing that thought, they refuse to do what is just, which is a rebellion against justice. And we have a God of justice, so that's a rebellion against God. And the principle is the wages of sin is death.
And the violence of the wicked sweeps them away. In this world, when violence is unleashed and cruel behavior seems to affect this boomerang. So it's like in this world, there's embedded a retribution that comes naturally. And cruelty does come back on those who exercise it.
The wicked often will resort to violence to get what they want. They will use violence because they're in a position of power and want to benefit themselves, and violence works. You take out your opposition, you intimidate your opposition, and you wind up, you know, being benefited. You invade another nation. You want their resources. The violence of the wicked is designed to help the wicked, to benefit them, but it winds up having the opposite effect. It sweeps them away. It harms them. So we should never resort to intimidation, violence, to benefit ourselves. Verse 8, the guilty walk a crooked path, the innocent travel a straight road. Rabbi Glenn.
Well, the idea here is that the person who's pure in heart, the righteous person, his conduct is going to be upright. And this is one of those verses that seems so obvious that you wonder, why even write this, right? It seems so obvious, but there's a reason here. And for me, the key has been to invert it. In other words, you can determine what kind of person you're dealing with by their actions. Again, as Messiah said, a tree is known by its fruit.
Martha.
And the picture of a crooked path, in my mind, I imagine, the guilty, the wicked, seeing the crooked path as a shortcut. I'm thinking, I don't want to go that long straight road. That's a lot of work. That's far. Here's a crooked path, and that'll get me there faster.
Alexandra.
But then they lead a crooked life, and it's usually a hard life, and it's usually not a satisfying life. So it's better off to be pure. And like the evangelist said to the Christian in Pilgrim's Progress, he said, stay on the narrow path. It's always straight, and all other paths are crooked. And sometimes they, you know, lead, there's crooked paths that come off of the straight one, but you have to just stay on the straight one.
Verse 9, it's better to live alone in the corner of an attic than with a quarrelsome wife in a lovely home. Martha, let's start with you.
This is especially good for people who are at the place in their life that they're contemplating marriage. This is advice, good advice. A lot of people think of a lovely home as being a goal. But in this case, it's warning us that the character of your mate is more important than any kind of lovely home or wealth or anything else, because that really makes the difference who you live with, your company. It's better to live alone in the corner of an attic than to live with someone who has a character of quarrelsomeness.
Alexandra.
Our inner lives, if they're jangled with stress and quarrels, are not comforted even by the best of surroundings. But I think it's so important to live in a peaceful and harmonious home as far as it depends on us. And the best combination is to have a really nice house and with lots of shalom.
Rabbi Glenn, you got both. Why don't you give us your thoughts?
Well, it's better to live alone in a corner of an attic than with a quarrelsome wife. I'm sure that's true, theoretically, but I wouldn't know. However, I do know one man. I know this one man whose wife was so critical of him, so demeaning toward him, even in front of others. And I wondered how he put up with it for so many years. I'd rather have solitude with shalom than live in a well-decorated house and be subject to incessant strife. It's like this goes along with another proverb that talks about better just a dry piece of toast and shalom with it than a house full of feasting or a fattened ox, but strife.
So, when it comes to choosing your mate, don't just look on the external aspects. Oh, she is so beautiful. She is so hot. She's such a fox. Men are attracted to, external beauty. You must look deeper. You must look at this woman's character. Is she kind? Is she gracious? Is she loving? Is she generous? Is she sweet? Right? And I also would have no practical knowledge of what this verse is about, only theoretical. All right, verse 10. Evil people desire evil. Their neighbors get no mercy from them. Rabbi Glenn.
Not too much to add to this. I mean, look, we're all sinners, right? We are all capable of doing wrong, but there are some people in this world who are just plain evil. Avaricious, cold-hearted, lacking, you know, even a flicker of mercy towards others. There are people like that. You hope that they're not people that are in your life.
You hope that they're not your next door neighbor.
Right.
Alexandra?
Similarly, it seems like there's two layers of evil and goodness in the Bible. Like on one hand, no one is righteous. No one does good. Everyone's heart is wicked. And yet there's a lot of talk about the wicked and the righteous, the innocent and the guilty. So it's like the good guys and the bad guys.
And there's something about evil once a person goes to the dark side. No, there is a twistedness that it does internally. And so that a person who has invited, you know, this evil twistedness into their way of thinking becomes incapable of even wanting to show mercy. And I think I was thinking about the naivete of appeasement in these situations where you think, oh, you know, they're being mean. I'll do something nice. I'll make them happy and it'll turn things around. No, that doesn't work with people like this.
Verse 11, if you punish a mocker, the simple-minded become wise. If you instruct the wise, they will be all the wiser. Martha, back to you.
Well, we talked about this. This is, to me, a picture of a continuum of teachability, where you have, on the one end, the mocker who is not teachable at all, just hard-hearted, making fun of everybody and everything. And on the other end, you have the wise person who only needs to be told something once. That's it. Then you have in the middle the simple-minded who are not hardened one way or the other and are able to, with a little more than being told once, to come around. And I think most of us tend to fall in that simple-minded category. We should strive to only have to be told once something by the Lord for correction, but we often are the ones who need more than that.
Rabbi Glenn.
Can we use the word laughingstock from time to time? A laughingstock was actually a thing. It was a public, it was a place out in public where somebody who had committed some kind of misdeed, their hands and their head would be through these stocks as a form of public humiliation for what they had done. And hence the term laughingstock. People would go by and cast insults and laugh at them for it. And the idea is that, and this is the redemptive side of punishment, that properly done, people can learn from it and think twice before they decide to become a mocker themselves. So there's a deterrent factor that's necessary and good here. But when you correct a wise person, they're going to take it to heart. They'll become that much wiser. So the goal for us, all of us, is, Lord, let me be teachable.
Alexandra.
I don't have anything to add to that.
Verse 12, the righteous one knows what is going on in the homes of the wicked. He will bring disaster on them. Alexandra.
I was thinking about walking in our neighborhood. It's so much fun to look at the houses and see what people are doing with their landscaping and what kind of changes they've made. And it's just so human. I mean, we look at the outside, we look at the house, we have no idea who lives there, what's going on. And it's that whole principle of God knowing what is going on in the heart and man looking on the outside appearance.
So a lot of horrible things can be going on in a lovely home, right? And you hear horror stories all the time about sexual abuse, incest, right? Abusive husbands, nasty wives.
This is highlighting that God is the one who knows what's happening behind the closed doors, even when we don't. And in the end, he will have justice. He will bring disaster on the wicked. Even when we don't even know what's going on, God does.
So just because something is done behind closed doors, just because something is private, doesn't mean that it's automatically right in God's sight, right? Rabbi Glenn.
God's omniscience can be, on the one hand, very disconcerting because he sees not just what we do in the privacy of our homes, he sees what we do in the interior of our mind and our heart. It's, on the one hand, disconcerting. On the other hand, it's comforting because he knows us, but also he knows the wicked. And so the other comforting aspect of his infinite knowledge is that nobody's getting away with anything. There's a day of reckoning ahead.
Verse 13, those who shut their ears to the cries of the poor will be ignored in their own time of need. Martha.
God has a design for community. How we treat one another, how we take care of our poor, our vulnerable, the weakest among us, is very much on the heart of God. And so to ignore the needs of the poor, to neglect the needs of the poor, actually ends up harming ourselves as well. In a society where every man is for himself, we'll fall apart. That's not God's design for society, for community. His design is that we take care of one another, and then we also get taken care of in that design, in that way.
Alexandra.
Well, I've never known how to interact with the various panhandlers in our neighborhood because there's one on every corner. And I know June always gives them food and money and Bible tracts. And, you know, I was passing under the bridge and I just saw piles of bags of food that people had given to the panhandlers. And I don't want to just have something thrown away. So I don't know if this is the right thing to do, but now when I see them, I just take a moment, I pray for them to be reconciled to their community or their family and find their purpose, that God obviously doesn't want them on the street like that, to find their purpose in their life. And that's just what I'm going to do until I know what better to do.
So what you're saying is there are legitimate cries of the legitimate poor, and then there are phony cries of panhandlers who are... How do you discern? You have to be wise when some, you know. But the real cries of the real needy, we have a moral, spiritual obligation to do something about. right? Rabbi Glenn.
Yeah, the context here is not the lazy, selfish, indigent, but those who are poor through perhaps no fault of their own. I think the presumption here is not like the panhandler type of person. But what is being said here? What's being said is what goes around comes around. You shut your ears to the cries of the poor. To do that is to be cold-hearted. And this is what is also referred to in Scripture as having an evil eye or a bad eye. In other words, one that has no pity on the less fortunate. And we got to be careful. Looking out for number one is the philosophy of this world. It's also the philosophy in hell. So we need to be thinking not just of ourselves, but we need to be thinking about those around us.
Verse 14, a secret gift calms anger. A bribe under the table pacifies fury. Rabbi Glenn.
Well, bribes are seen in Scripture generally not as a good thing, but in certain contexts, a gift, bribe, can ameliorate someone's anger. But generally, a bribe is not a good thing. So better than all of that is to just stay out of trouble in the first place. Don't get in somebody's fury. Don't do things that are going to put you in a position where you have to go to extreme lengths to try to fix a situation. Just stay out of trouble.
Verse 14, Alexandra.
Well, you can say that, but sometimes we get into trouble. And I think bribes are bad. They're just bad. But gifts, you think about it. You go to somebody's house, you bring a gift. They graduate, you bring a gift. We give gifts all the time. And I think if I've done something to upset somebody, you know, you bring a peace offering, you bring them a little gift and have a talk. And it helps. It paves the way.
Pizza.
Yes, there are plenty of times that we'd like to stay out of trouble, but we can't. There are things that happen. And I think it's significant that the way that the gift is given, how the gift is given quietly in secret to appease, it's not something that, you know, anybody else knows about. And I actually have an image in my mind of an experience that we had and with a neighbor who was very angry with us over something that happened with the property. And I observed how Lauren handled it just like this verse recommended, and it turned things around. Now they love us.
Excellent.
People like gifts. When you do something wrong, you offend someone, you bring them a gift, you appease them. That's what a sacrifice to God is about, a sacrifice of an animal. It appeases his displeasure, his anger that we've offended him. That's what the sacrifice of the Son of God is about. It's a sacrifice that appeases God's, that appeases God. And the same thing applies to our relationship with fellow human beings. So if you offend someone and they're not just listening to your words, you, a peace offering. You up it. You up the ante. You say, I've got something for you. Here's a gift certificate. Here's a couple $100. You know, take your wife out to dinner. Treats on me. Something like that. And it has an amazing way of appeasing and restoring a relationship.
It can even open doors. Ray Comfort, frequently when he's doing evangelism at the beach or wherever he is, he's got these people that come, and initially they're looking for trouble. They're looking for an argument. And he offers them a gift card, like a $5 gift card to Burger King or whatever, if they'll just answer a few questions. And as a consequence, people are, their demeanor changes, and they're sometimes glad to answer questions, and some of these interviews become very redemptive.
Final verse for this morning, justice is a joy to the godly. Gives them happiness, joy, when something right and just takes place, or an injustice is righted. But it terrifies, very upsetting, terrifies evildoers. Rabbi Glenn.
Rightly so. And yesterday's decision out of the Supreme Court illustrates this fact. Those who have reverence for God and are committed to the sacredness of human life at all stages are rejoicing at the news that Roe versus Wade has been overturned. On the other hand, those who despise God's moral law and who champion the killing of babies in the womb were either livid or terrified at what this will mean. Rightly so. We should rejoice at a good decision. And this is the thing. One and the same action, when justice is accomplished, is going to have two diametrically opposed reactions. Those reactions tell you who that person is.
I was going to say the same exact thing. You mark those who are upset, who are speaking out against this decision, who are angry. You mark these people. These are the evildoers. And you mark those who are happy and, you know, delighted about this overturn of this wicked, evil decree. Those are people who are godly. Alexandra, any thoughts?
No, it's just that it came to life yesterday, that proverb.
Mm-hmm. Nothing to add.
Thank you, Rabbi Glenn, Alexandra, Martha.